Middle Platonism and Neoplatonism, Part 1, the 20th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 24, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handouts mentioned in this talk are handouts number 7 and 8 in this series.
We have been talking about Roman and Hellenistic philosophy. The last section that we didn't get to is Neopythagoreanism, and it probably arguably belongs in my next set of notes anyway, so I'm just going to lump them all together and get started there. The next set of notes is going to be Middle Platonism and Neoplatonism, so that's obviously talking specifically about the influence and impact of Plato, but that whole era is, if you'll notice on my last week's notes, the eclecticism of this period. It starts with Roman and Hellenistic philosophy, but when you get into later antiquity, so between the ancient world and the medieval world, that's what they call later antiquity. In later antiquity, eclecticism is the is what it's all about. You know what eclecticism is? You're eclectic when you pick and choose from different philosophical systems, a little bit from here and a little bit from there and a little bit from here and a little bit from here. So the tendency in the late antiquity was to borrow some things from the Stoics, borrow some things from the Epicureans, keep a little from Plato, borrow a little from Aristotle, whatever else might be around, and kind of combine them into your own particular system. You roll your own system out of the elements that are available to you. And everybody during this time, and I mean everybody, is eclectic. So when we talk about the Middle Platonists, we'll have to talk about in what sense are they Platonists, but they're basically eclectics, and so is Neoplatonism, and so is Neopythagoreanism, and so on. So where do these names come from? If they're all just eclectic, why is somebody a Neoplatonist and somebody a Neopythagorean and somebody else is a Middle Platonist? Why the title? It really doesn't have to do with anything distinctive about their worldview or their philosophies, because if we had time to examine them in detail, we'd realize how much they overlap. They really believe much the same kinds of things. But the Neopythagoreans reverence Pythagoras, and they fancy themselves to be disciples of Pythagoras. The Middle Platonists like Plato, and they fancy themselves to be carrying on the tradition of Plato. So basically, they all believe roughly the same sorts of things, but one person does it in the name of Pythagoras, and the next person does it in the name of Plato. No one seems to do it in the name of Aristotle at this point. So, in other words, they're all eclectic. They're all drawing on the same elements. All of them have elements of Stoicism in them. All of them have taken something from Pythagoras and Pythagoreanism. All of them have taken something from Plato. So, without exception, they have all borrowed from all of the main players, but they have combined them in unique and distinctive kinds of ways. But so unique and distinctive that you won't find every Middle Platonist teaching the same thing. They teach different things. And the Neopythagoreans don't teach the same thing. They teach different things. So the only thing they share in common is their reverence for Pythagoras, if you're a Neopythagorean, or Plato, if you're a Middle or Neoplatonist. So don't think of these as schools of thought or systems of thought, because that's not what we're dealing with any of these people. So is that clear enough? So on the notes from last time, So I have all these distinctive doctrines under the Neopythagoreans, but I probably could have put that same list, virtually the same list, with some adjustments under the Middle Platonists as well. So I'm just giving you a feel for what happened when this eclectic process began to take place. So I list these several distinctive doctrines here. A, everything is derived from the monad, or the point. Now, if you remember when we talked about Pythagoras, remember for the Pythagoreans, everything is number. Everything starts from the number one, and the number one divides into a dyad, and then you have other numbers unfolding from that number. To our ears, just seems like the most bizarre thing in the world. You know, things are made of numbers, but we won't revisit Pythagoras. But everything is derived from the monad for them. Now, that's going to have a huge, huge impact on Christianity. And so if we're talking about the Bible and the history of ideas, it's the influence of this late antiquity and the ideas they developed and how that made its way into Christianity, that's the real story, is one of the major stories about how Christianity began to go this way. The Bible would go this way, but Christianity is going this way. It's because of these intrusion of these pagan ideas that begin to get adopted by the early Christian thinkers. And one of them is the oneness of the one. The ultimate being is the monad. So there are many theologians in the Middle Ages where the Jews said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God." Well, all they mean is they're not polytheist God. There's only one God. But the oneness of the one God becomes a really big deal in the Middle Ages. He is undivided and indivisible. He is simple. He's unchanging. Everything that the Pythagoreans would say about the monad is going to get shifted over and said about God in Christianity. Now, maybe not absolutely everything, but virtually everything, and by some more than others in the theologians of the Middle Ages. So this unitary being whose main feature is that he is unitary and one becomes the source of everything. Notice how hard it is to make a monad into a person. It tends to suck the personhood of God right out of him for the most part. Now, obviously medieval theologians are going to say he's a person, but see the tension? He's a person. No, he's a monad. He's a one. And it's difficult to see how you can maintain both at the same time. They also introduced the notion of emanation. And again, different. We'll talk a lot about emanation when we get to Neoplatonism, because Plotinus is the one who really, really emphasizes emanation. But emanation, a metaphor that Plotinus will eventually use, is it's like God is a fountain. And filled to the brim of the fountain and overflowing. But the water never diminishes in the source. It's always overflowing without ever being diminished. Or Plotinus will use the imagery of the sun. The sun is always emanating its light, but never being diminished. Now, he wasn't modern physicist, so he didn't know. But from as far as he knew, as far from his perspective, the sun just never went away. It never became depleted. It was never going to run out. It had this magical quality of being able to shine its rays on everything, give life, heat, energy to the world without ever diminishing itself at all. Well, that's how the one operates, is that everything is derived from the one through a process of emanation. So everything is kind of sort of God, Now, this isn't really pantheism, though, that it would be wrong to think of it as pantheism, because it's not a piece of God. It's not that part of God's presence is down here. God's presence is in the one and only in the one. But our being is derived from having, we're the drippings of God, the divine drippings. Now, these are Pythagoreans, right? So the further you fall away from the one, the less real you are, the less good you are. So it literally is a falling away from the one. There's a kind of falling into darkness. So this world is a dark, evil, corrupt, impermanent place, because the very nature of our being is such that it has fallen away from being itself. You would equate the one with being itself in Pythagoreanism, borrowing a little bit from Plato there, probably. But notice then, when you get as low as we are, as far away from the one as we are, there's a huge moral and ontological gap between the one and us. How can there be any contact? How can there be any communication? What does light have to do with darkness? What does goodness have to do with evil? What does being have to do with non-being? They can't just like hang out together. So having any kind of relationship, contact, let alone relationship with the one, is out of the question. So how do we solve the problem of this incredible, unbridgeable gap between the one and the world? Well, you fill it with a bunch of intermediate beings. So things that are a little bit more real than we are, and there are things that are a little bit more real than they are, and things that are a little bit more real than they are, until you get up to something that's pretty real, not too much less than the one, the monad itself. And you basically have this hierarchy of beings. We already saw that in Plato, right? But what Plato outlined, this late antiquity, just runs with that in a vengeance. So you have a whole sturdy ladder of beings sticking out there. And if you can climb up the ladder of being, then you can get to the top. But there's a whole hierarchy of being with all kinds of, I call them creatures, existing things that exist at different levels in between.
Is there a continuous falling away and a possibility to rise up through that again then?
Well, we'll see this more in Neoplatonism, but Plotinus was a flaming mystic, as was Philo that we were looking at, and probably some of the Neo-Pythagoreans were as well. They're mystical. All of these late philosophies in the late antiquity, the difference between them and a religion is indistinguishable. They're virtually just different religions. And all of them have some way for the human soul, because in all of these cases, there's a distinction between my body and my mind, my body and my soul. My soul has more affinities with higher up things. My body, of course, doesn't, but my soul does. Well, because my soul is more real and more spiritual, there's the possibility for my soul to detach itself from my body in some sense, to become freed of my body and to ascend up. And ideally, it will be united with the one. That's what we're going to find out in Plotinus. And so his biographer talks about four times in the 6 years that his biographer Porphyry was living with him or hanging out with him, he had an experience of being united with the one. I don't know how you know that from the outside, but he had an ecstatic experience, some kind of ecstatic experience, that Plotinus claimed was he lost all sense of himself, had no self-consciousness, and was completely unaware of himself and had been absorbed into being itself and become united with being itself in this mystical experience. So, it's very reminiscent of Hinduism. Yeah, very reminiscent. I have to believe that they did. I mean, it is so, I mean, the similarities between them are so uncanny that I have to think that there's some shared source. I didn't know what to do with that in my early studies of philosophy, but after going through the curriculum here in Gutenberg, I've come to realize there was a lot more contact in the ancient world than we kind of tend to picture. Charlie has pointed out that there are minerals or something in Britain that are only found in Southeast Asia, you know, from the ancient world in archaeological finds. So the trade was way more extensive than we think. I was reading Aristotle, and he talked about being in Athens, and there were some Druids there. I mean, who would have thunk? But I mean, the more you get these little clues that the world was a lot smaller than I thought it was in the ancient world. Charlie has read that Basques routinely fished the Great Banks off of Newfoundland. You know, we think of Columbus as finding America, but actually, no, that there was all kinds of contact. I mean, rather intrepid souls that made it over here. But the world was smaller than we realize. So the idea of India and the Near East sharing some kind of common philosophical is not at all unthinkable. Yeah. For Neopythagoreanism, well, basically, Philo, if you'll notice on today's, is 25 BC. We're basically talking about 25 BC to, by the time you get to Plotinus, we're talking about 300 or so AD. So it's the first three centuries. Another thing, talking about the influence on Christian theology, the Neopythagoreans believed in the utter transcendence of God beyond all categories. Talk about similarity with Hinduism. That's right here. That the ultimate being, the one, is not, you can't really talk about the one, the monad, being good. They would likely consider it, same thing with Plotinus coming up. Plotinus calls the one goodness, but you can't say of goodness that it is good or evil, because the one transcends all distinctions, just transcends all categories. That's exactly like Brahman Hinduism. So, and that has a strong, strong current throughout the Middle Ages. That there are two ways of approaching God in the Middle Ages. One was called the via negativa, the way of negation, and the other was the via positiva. The via negativa, the only thing you could ever say about God is that he wasn't something. But you could never make any claim about what God was, because God is always too much other, too much beyond, too much above it all to be able to be captured by our categories positively. You could certainly say, well, that category doesn't belong to him, so you can negate any category that you might, but you can't positively claim of God anything about him. So you can't say God is good the via negativa. Then there were those who opposed that, who wanted to hold out the via positiva. No, there are some things that we can say about God. But the fact that it's even a debate, right? The fact that there are people who would even advocate that nothing positive can be said about God, where is that coming from? Well, it's not coming from the Bible. So it's some other influence, and I would argue it's out of late antiquity. It's this very concept of transcendence that's shared by the Neopythagoreans and the Middle Platonists and basically anyone else who's rolling their own theology at this point in time. Now, let's talk about the Bible for a second. I think there's something true in this conception of God being above it all. I think there's something true about that. That is, if we were to look at, let me put it this way, God so transcends reality that if God did not reveal something about himself in terms of this reality, within this reality, if he did not become, if he did not express himself within this reality, then what could we know about God? Nothing. And knowing nothing, we wouldn't have any way of knowing what categories apply and what categories don't apply. So we are utterly and completely dependent upon God's self-revelation. He has to reveal himself to us that he is good and not evil. He has to reveal to us, to himself, that he is a person, that he's not just an impersonal force. We know that because of his revelation, not because we would have any way of having access to seeing, observing, experiencing, knowing God in and of himself. And I think that's probably what that's the insight that gives plausibility to the via negativa, even though it's fundamentally false, I think, because it's ignoring the Bible, ignoring what the Bible says. But in any case, this is that concept of God that leads to the via negativa is completely at home in Neopythagoreanism, Middle Platonism, and late antiquity. The Platonic forms now in Neopythagoreanism become ideas in the mind of God. Remember, with Plato, it wasn't clear where you were supposed to stick him. He's kind of a tension in Plato. The demiurge who makes the world has to reference the ideas wherever they are, kind of looks at them and copies them. But by the time you get to late antiquity, we have placed them squarely in the mind of the ultimate being, assuming it has a mind, or if it's not a mind, at least it's a part of the ultimate one, the monad. The ideas are there inherently, naturally, and essentially within the monad itself. So God now, remember this hierarchy of being I talked about, they will typically talk about God as being divided into one, two, three, or more gods. Philo is going to talk about the Logos being the second god. You call it the second god. And each level of God is going to be successively lower than the one before it. And then, of course, I've basically already alluded to this, that when the soul enters into the body of a human being, that's a fall. That's a fall from perfection, or a fall from goodness, a fall from being. And the body is our problem in Neopythagoreanism. I think that had a huge impact on Christianity. It for decades, centuries, maybe even down to this very day, it's not at all uncommon for Christians to think in terms of the real problem in my existence is my body. If I could just get rid of my body, I would be fine. It's my body that tempts me. It's my body that drags me down. It's my body that does this, my body that does that. And oftentimes we think of death as a kind of final freedom. That's when I can be saved. That's when I can be made whole, when I get rid of this body. Well, that is radically different from the biblical perspective, because the Bible knows no such thing as disembodied existence. We are not, unless there's something I don't know, I don't think there's any stage of our existence where we will be disembodied. We will always have a body that is my interface between who I am as a person, what the Bible calls my soul, who I am as a person, and the reality that I'm a part of. My body is how I interface with it. So a modern problem in philosophy is even trying to make sense out of disembodied existence. There are a lot of philosophers today who would argue it's a completely incoherent concept. Notice what we do at the popular level. Notice that most people who believe in disembodied existence don't really believe in disembodied existence. They believe that there's a Casper the Ghost version of themselves, which isn't really disembodied because that's a quasi-body. It has the shape of a body. It takes space just like a body does. I'm dating myself, but you know who Casper the Friendly Ghost is, right? But, you know, there's a little translucent version of me that looks just like me, who can kind of float out of me and then go anywhere. That's my soul, right? Isn't that how most people in the church think about the soul? They're actually thinking about a body. The idea of actually not having a body is barely thinkable. It's not a problem for biblical Christianity, because biblical faith never ever posits that we never have a body. God always gives us a body. The next body is going to be better than this one, but it's still a body.
I think
I'm not trying to ignore you. I'm just trying to look pretty for the camera.
So. Oh, sure. It's all good. It's all good. I think that the idea of re-embodied existence, e.g. resurrection, as opposed to disembodied existence, is the most powerful, or one of the most powerful ideas of the afterlife, because it takes so many philosophical things into account.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, given what you just said, what do you think of the text in John's Apocalypse where it depicts these martyrs who are beheaded and they're in some kind of intermediary state? Now, with a cultural backdrop, much like the belief of Muslims and things like that, there was a lot of beliefs that a martyr instantly went into the presence of God, whereas your average Joe Blow person subscribing to the religion had to wait until the final resurrection. Muslims think that's why people blow themselves up, and that's been thought for a long time, so maybe that's in the background. But what do you think about these martyrs in some kind of intermediary state in John's Apocalypse?
I don't think that that's in the role that plays in Revelation. I think there are a few visions that are kind of interludes in Revelation that are not realistic events.
Yeah.
They are purely symbolic and representative events that will never, ever take place in the whole history of the cosmos. I mean, you could never have a video camera of whatever sensitivity to whatever light waves you want, but mm-hmm. you could never have a videotape of that event, because that event ain't going to happen.
Yeah, that's a cool way to take it. So you're saying it says, like, there's these martyrs under the throne, and they're calling day and night, oh God, you know, avenge our blood upon, right. you know, these people. And well, it never happened, but... Or it's not going to happen.
It has never happened and never will happen, yeah.
But it's the...
But it represents...
It's what it's saying that matters.
Profoundly true, yeah.
So what is the biblical view of anatomy? Is what we think of as our soul and spirit considered our mind? Or how do you put that together from the Bible?
Okay. I think the first realization that I came to is that words like soul, spirit... What else does the Bible use? Can't think of anything off the top. But soul and spirit are kind of like our words, character, personality, disposition. I mean, we have a lot of words that we use where you would never dream of going, well, where's your character? And could you have a characterotomy, please? Or a personality-otomy, please, because a personality transplant, maybe. We would never think in those terms, because we know we're not talking about something that exists, that has being. We're talking about a way of describing a pattern of behavior on the part of this being. So take something like my character. My character doesn't cause me to act. To talk about what my character is to look at the pattern of my choices and my actions and my behavior and say the pattern of his behavior is like this, not like that. So character is an abstraction. You following me? Well, I think soul and spirit in the Bible, I can't do any better than that, but I think soul and spirit in the Bible is very similar. It's not like the soul is an entity within me. the soul is the best word, the word we would use, I think, translating into modern world would be person. The souls under the altar were the persons under the altar. What makes me the individual person that I am as opposed to some other person is my distinctive soul. I have my soul. And so everything that makes this person is what the Bible tries to capture by talking about me being a soul. Unlike an animal that is not a person or a rock that is not a person, they don't have a soul in the Bible. They are soulless because they are personless. They're not persons. And spirit can be used, well, not, I don't know that it ever means person. Soul, I think, sometimes maybe can be used interchangeably with spirit. But spirit tends to be getting at the inward driving, defining essence of what makes me me. So when it contrasts the spirit with the flesh, the spirit is when the Spirit of God comes and tweaks who I am in the deepermost parts of my being such that I begin to go a different direction. I'm reoriented. I used to be oriented to be hostile to God. Now I'm oriented toward being friendly toward God. I want to obey Him. I want to know Him. I want to love Him. Well, where did that tweaking happen? At the deepest, most level of what makes me me. Whenever it's wanting to go deep, it talks about my spirit. My soul can be pretty superficial. Because part of what makes me the person that I am are superficial things like how I laugh, how I smile, what kind of disposition I have. All that can be incorporated in my soul, but not my spirit. My spirit is talking about the inner wellsprings of my relationship to God and all the implications of that. Does that help? Okay. Well, we're ready to go on to Middle Platonism per se. I've already mentioned why it's called Middle Platonism. The most important Middle Platonist for our purposes, if we're interested in the Bible and contrasting it with the Bible, is Philo. And we won't have time to finish him, but we can get started here. Philo was born in roughly 25 BC. They don't know exactly when he died, but somewhere after 40 AD. So notice that he's basically a contemporary with Jesus. So in his chronology is interesting. Philo lived in Alexandria. Philo lived in Alexandria, which was in Egypt. was a major city state in Egypt, and Alexandria had a ton of Jews living in it. Now, why did they have a ton of Jews living there? When you think of the history of Israel, many of the Jews during all those times when Judea and even before that Israel were conquered first by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians, occasionally harassed by the Egyptians, during every one of those forays, Jews would escape with their life by fleeing Judah or Israel. And some of them fled to Arabia. Some of them fled, ultimately made their way to Ethiopia, but many of them went to Egypt. So they began to congregate in various city-states in Egypt. Alexandria was a major center for the Jews. It was such a major center for the Jews that they had their own, what's the Greek word, polytereia? That's not quite right. But basically, neighborhood watch? No. Their own little city within the city, their own government, they had their own civic affairs. And Philo was active in some of that. In fact, Philo, toward the end of his life, was sent as an emissary to Caesar because there is a major riot in Alexandria where some Jews had done something to get the Gentiles upset, and the Gentiles came in and killed a bunch of Jews, and it was a major, major riot. And in order to pacify Rome, the Jews sent Philo and some others to Caesar to kind of still the waters. Philo is a Jew. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I was going to get around to saying that. The reason I'm talking about the Jews in Alexandria is because Philo is one of them. As best we can tell, Philo was a what we today would call an observant Jew. That what I mean by that is he took the practices and rituals and piety of Judaism very seriously. So Sabbath keeping, circumcision, dietary stuff. You know, we don't know exactly what his life consisted of, but he seems to have nothing but the highest regard for the traditions and practices of the Jews. However, when it came to philosophy, he was just basically a Platonist and a very avid lover of Plato and fancied himself a follower of Plato. So his project, okay, step back for a second. Most of his writings, about 70 to 80% of his writings, are commentary on Scripture, on Torah. So it's not that we have a systematic philosophy from Philo. You have to put it together by these various soliloquies that he would go on when he's talking about some verse out of the Bible, out of the Old Testament, and he would comment on that, as ancient commentators were wont to do, and they will comment by introducing their own perspectives on life and reality and so on, thinking that this verse is a good stepping off point to talk about that. So that you have to piece together his philosophy from his commentaries mostly. Well, what is he doing? What's his project? His project is to try to reconcile Judaism with Plato. And why would you want to reconcile Judaism with Plato, or how would you think it's justified to reconcile Judaism with Plato? Well, he goes so far as to say, well, Plato was a disciple of Moses. Now, obviously, there's no historical evidence for any such claim. It's in a lot of ways, it's an outrageous claim, but it's a claim that Philo is making, that Plato learned everything he knew from Moses. So obviously, by reading Plato and understanding Plato, I'm getting an inside look into what Moses actually thought and what Moses actually believed. Following me? So his task is to show us, go to the Scriptures and show us all the various ways that we're seeing Plato's philosophy being expressed and taught and communicated by the Scriptures. Well, that's going to be kind of a task to do that. I mean, how are you going to do that? How are you going to find Plato in the Torah? Recognizing the problem, he borrowed from the Stoics and others who had begun to do a similar thing with the Greek mythology. Let me back up for a second. In the Greek mythology, you have the gods doing some pretty awful things sometimes. Rape, murder, treachery of one kind or another. Stuff that isn't really becoming of gods. So did our gods really do that? Did Zeus really do that? I mean, is that really how we are to understand the gods? No. So we have to find a way of understanding the myths, the mythical story about them, that doesn't make us take the base behavior of the gods seriously. So they began to allegorize the myths. Well, Philo then takes that over from the Stoics and takes that over into his interpretation of what we call the Old Testament. He begins to allegorize it. Now, there's a big difference, though, between what the Stoics did and what Philo did. The Stoics didn't allegorize anything, everything. They just allegorized what was inconvenient. Philo sees the whole Torah as an extended allegorical teaching. And yet, he's a Jew, right? You can't disregard the literal meaning of the text. You must take it seriously. So if it says to circumcise, you circumcise. If it says to follow the dietary regulations, you follow the dietary regulations. The Stoics would allegorize in such a way that they would ignore the literal meaning of it and just look at the real meaning, the spiritual meaning behind it. Philo maintains both simultaneously. There's the literal meaning of the text, and there's the allegorical meaning of the text. And both are from God. That becomes very influential in Christianity. Remember, Philo is in Alexandria. There's a group of Christian church fathers called the Alexandrian Fathers. Clement is the older one, and then eventually Origen, who's better known. They're in Origen. They're in Origen. They're in Alexandria, and they are they're actively reading Philo and learning from Philo. They adopt their interpretation of Scripture. They adopt his method of levels of meaning of Scripture and introduce it into Christianity. So from the Alexandrian Fathers on, you have theologians. We read here in Gutenberg, can't remember the title, but Augustine's book on how to read the Bible on Christian doctrine. Thank you. Yeah, on Christian doctrine, and basically it's his method for understanding the Scriptures and reading the Scriptures, and that's just clear as day. There's several levels of meaning of the text, and you need to look at the different texts and discover what various levels of meaning are relevant to you. That's ultimately coming from Philo.
Even in the Old Testament, where God says, circumcise your hearts, that's a bit allegorical. And he talks, isn't it? I mean, he says circumcision is physical, but he also says circumcise your hearts. And then
well,
he talks
that's
about,
I wouldn't call it allegory, that's a metaphor.
Okay, because he does the same with sacrifice. He says, I don't want your bulls and offerings, I want your hearts.
Uh-huh.
So you would say that's metaphor rather than another well, this, level of looking
well, specifically,
at.
Circumcise your heart is a metaphor based on the physical requirement of circumcision. And then he's going one step further and saying, but you know what? The physical act of circumcision doesn't really make you a true child of God. What really needs to be circumcised mm-hmm. is your heart. And the circumcised part is, I don't mean that literally, yeah. but do you see there's an analogy between God putting the mark of his ownership of me on my spirit, on my deep innermost being, as opposed to putting the mark of his ownership on my body. They're not just appreciative of metaphor in the Bible, because it's hard, it would be impossible to read the Bible and not recognize you're going to have to allow for metaphor, because the authors of the biblical text sometimes speak metaphorically rather than strictly literally. That's just normal. That's just understanding it to be human language. In allegory, you're understanding what it means on a surface level, and it makes all the sense in the world on a surface level. Whether you like it or not is another question, but it makes all the sense in the world. But it's to look at that and go, you know, but I think God meant something else here too. I'll just give you one, next time, try to remind me, and I'll give you an example out of Augustine. Okay, eventually get to Augustine. Augustine takes the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritan, the Jew is beaten by the side of the road. The Samaritan comes along, takes care of him. What is that a story of? Well, on the one hand, it's a story of somebody who takes care of a Samaritan who takes care of a Jew. But allegorizing it, and see if I can remember all these things. The inn that he takes him to is the church. He binds up his wounds and puts oil and, what does he do? Something. That's wine, yeah. That's the Eucharist. That's allegorizing. Okay.